Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and this daily update for day three from the East Coast Mind Jam opens with Tony Spina, who is thanking people for coming to the Mind Jam, and Eric Citron then kind of asking for a few people from the audience to give their recollections and stories about Tony. I thought you might enjoy hearing some of the things that people have to say for Tony, and an award has been presented to Tony for this particular weekend, and it really was quite touching, some of the words that Tony had to say, even though he was in poor health and maybe kind of difficult to hear. So be sure, you might want to turn this up to make sure that you can hear what Tony has to say. Following that, we then go into Now You See It with Scott Wells. This was a special episode that opened with Patrick Redford as my first guest. We were trying to fill some time because Mark Salem was delayed, having coming over directly from England in order to do his one-man show, and then followed with a lecture to complete this East Coast Mind Jam. So, please enjoy the update from day three at the East Coast Mind Jam.
It's such a wonderful feeling to know all your friends, and it's just wonderful to see all of you guys. You have no idea. And I'd love to say a lot more things. But I want to give Eric back the microphone, and again, thank you all, really sincerely.
If anybody has a Tony Spina story, a brief one they'd like to share with the group, that'd be great. I kind of want to just make this a little bit of a celebration of what Tony's done for everybody in the Magic community. Tony, as you guys know, was the first one to give David Copperfield his first professional job and countless others, and he's helped in an unselfish manner over and over and over again. And this was my way to say thank you to him for everything he's done. I know him since I'm 12 years old, and it's been a great experience. He's a great guy, and I just want to say thank you. And if anybody has anything they'd like to say to Tony, I'd be more than happy to turn the microphone over to you.
Hi, Tony. My name is Jonathan Levy, and I don't know if you remember me, but I certainly remember you. I grew up in Teaneck, came over the bridge every weekend to Tannins. You, Irv, Lou were wonderful as a 12, 13-year-old kid. I just remember walking in with a little bit of money I had saved up, and you showed me. You said, "You gotta see this. This is something new. You got." And everyone, the crowd came around, you know, the counters, and you did the Astrosphere, which was wonderful. You know, people know that with the golden silk that I still have today in use. And you came in a pinch. Every time I needed you, I'd call you up long distance for a wallet. And you'd say, "I got the best one." And I'd say, "Where's it from?" "I don't know. I picked it up in Spain, or I got the silk cylinder you sent me. There was rabbit fur in there. I was concerned maybe you were using it first." And no. Just believe me, it's the best one. And it was. So you really did great, and we love you, and we're so happy you're here. You meant a lot, and you mean a lot to us in our lives. Thank you.
I have a couple of tributes. Unfortunately, we had the screen taken down. But when I was in Mindvention this past year, I met with a few of your friends. And I'll just play the audio. But this is from Jeff McBride.
You guys know who Jeff McBride is, right?
Vegas, saying hello and thinking about all of the great memories and even the birthday call that you gave me on my birthday when I was like 13 years old, and all the times we spent together, how much you've done for my career, not only my career, but all of my friends and countless magicians that you've touched with your magic and your life and your mentoring. I just want to say that I miss you, I love you, and I'm filled with memories, and your legend lives on with the thousands of magicians that you've inspired. It's Jeff McBride from Las Vegas.
That was Jeff McBride. I have one from
I have one from Teller, from Penn and Teller. You guys know who he is, I'm sure.
Hi, Tony. This is Teller. My life, and I thank you very much for everything you've done for me all through the years, and I wish you the very best. I hope it comes out well. I'm here in Las Vegas, and you're here there. Nice to say hi. Hi.
I have one from Bob Cassidy as well. You guys, I'm sure you know who he is.
Tony, really wish I could be here with you. Long time no see, man. I hope you have a wonderful time. It's well deserved. Good thoughts to you, Tony.
And the next and last one is from Danny Archer and Robert Allen. Once I told them I wasn't going to do this again, they were very happy. And here you go.
Welcome. And greetings from Las Vegas. Robert Allen.
Hey, Danny Archer. How you doing, Tony? Good to see you.
Come up to Vegas. Mindvention. If you can't come, get rid of the walker. We know that's a roof. You know, get out. There's nothing wrong with you. Get out of here, Tony.
Tony has always been a class guy. We're sorry we're not able to be there with you. But, Tony, you have a great time. And everybody, have a great time at the Jersey Mind Gym.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Sorry we can't be there.
Well, there you have it. That's just a little bit of the sentiment that I know thousands of people that you've helped. If anybody else would like to tell a brief story, you're more than welcome. Oh, here you go.
Hi, my name is Roger Monaco. I've known Tony for 40 years. I first came into Tannins when I was 18 or 19. And he showed me a trick called the gypsy thread trick, which I bought immediately, and I started doing in my professional act from then on. I had a great time with Tony. I showed him tricks that I invented, and one day I did this coins across for him, and he wanted me to show Harry Blackstone Jr., who was in the back room, so he called Harry Blackstone out to the front room. And he came over to me, and I said, I got a trick to show you. I fooled Derek Dingle with it. I fooled everybody I ever done it for. And I'm going to do it for you. So I had three quarters and a Chinese coin. One hand to the other. And I said, did it fool you? He said, totally. I don't know how the f*** you did that. I know, I did it twice for Derek Dingle. And he said, I don't know how you're doing that. Anyway, I put it on the market, sold a few of them. But anyway, that's my story of Tony. I call you once in a while when you are home. I don't have your hospital number anymore, I don't think. I might. Anyway, that's my tribute to Tony Spina.
Hey, Tony, I don't know if you remember me, Richard Osterlin. Now, I grew up in your shop, man. You should come down there every Saturday. And then when I got a little bit older, you actually started carrying my stuff. And I remember when you booked me for the Jubilee. I don't know if you remember that, Tony. And that was a big night for me. I couldn't wait. I'm going to be at the Pan and Jubilee. And what does he do? He puts me opposite David Copperfield. And finally, I went up to Tony begging him. I said, Tony, can't you move my time? You know, who's going to come and see me? So you did. And that was a great time. And just so good to see you again, Tony. God bless you.
Mr. Devin Knight.
Okay, I'm going to, so Tony can see who I am, so he'll remember me. A lot of people don't know this about me, but I went into Tannins when I was like 22 years old and was doing close-up. And Tony says, how would you like to be a world-famous magician? Which eventually I did become. And he says, I'm going to give you the opportunity to be one of the Mystic Three. That's what he called us. And he took me to the back secret room, and he had this great illusion called a tube doubt, you know, the upright box. I was one of the three people. So I had my girlfriend with me. You took me to the back room. She got into the box. And we said, we love it. He said, only three in the world. He says, you got one. So he sold me the first one. And then after that, he sold me probably about 10 illusions over the next few years. But that was, if a lot of you know, I did in the early 80s, I toured with a huge illusion show, like 13 people in the cast. And Tony was the person who got that started because she said, go in the back room, I got something I want to show you. The tube out, you'll be part of my Mystic Three Club. And the thing that's so funny about this is that when he sent it to me, and of course the thing worked perfectly, And I know you won't remember this, but I tried to do it, and I didn't turn, the tube was like an octagon, so it wouldn't fit into it. So I called up Tony and says, what the hell is going on? I said, the tube doesn't fit. And he got this guy, his worker, on the line, and he says, the tube doesn't fit. And the guy says, it did fit, you know. And Tony says, customer's always right, he says, Devin says it doesn't fit, you know, what's going on here? And then later I turned to tube where that did fit. Boy, I was so embarrassed. But anyhow, I want to thank you, Tony. I said for about 10 years I toured, you know, with a huge illusion show. Then later I gave it up to become a mentalist because it was a lot easier to carry, you know, thumb tips and bullets than a couple tons of illusion. So thank you very much. I mean, you really the one who made my career, because once I bought that illusion from you, it was a cool illusion, and I got booked all over the country. People said, wow, I love that illusion. So thank you so much. Because if it wasn't for Tony, I would not be in magic now. I'd probably work in the store. Thank you so much.
Anybody else? Nobody? Yeah.
My name is Jim Tony. I, like pretty much everybody here, went to the shop as often as I could. Most kids in America dream of going to Disney World. And first time I went to Disney World, it was magic. But it didn't compare to the first time I walked into 120 West 42nd Street. You were the guy that greeted me, and I couldn't believe that there was a store that only sold magic. It was a mind-boggling concept. And you greeted me, you did Glorpy, and I can still hear you say the name Glorpy, the way you kind of sang it when you did your routine. I too was taught the gypsy thread by you, and kept thinking, what a cool job to stand behind the counter and demo magic. And all during my teenage years and college years, I thought, what a cool job. And then I went to grad school and I was about to become a lawyer, and you looked at me and turned to Jack and said, you know, he'd be a great demo guy here. We should offer him a job. And I was about to be a lawyer, and I thought, oh, now he's offering me the job. And I went home and I seriously thought about it. I didn't take the job, but years later I quit being a lawyer and became a full-time magician, so I should have heeded your call earlier. Thank you, Tony. Thanks for everything, man.
So everybody's talking about the magic shop, and I love the magic shop, but it was the Jubilee. Everything was about the Jubilee for me. I went to the last 25 Jubilees. And I started at the Browns, and every time I went there, you always greeted everybody. Are you having a good time? Is there anybody that you want to meet? And, you know, walking down the hall and seeing Frank Garcia and Paul Harris and this one and that one, and you just opened up magic to everybody with these conventions. And I looked for, my wife always used to say, Jubilee! You know, like she used to make fun of me going to the Jubilee. But to me, you almost had the reunion. I think I was the first registrant, you told me. And I wish it would have happened, but today is like our Jubilee, so thank you for that.
I'm sorry. Bill Tower here. The Jubilee was, and the Saturdays, I remember some of the magical moments in my life at the Jubilee when you did... When you not only saw the lady in thirds, but removed the middle, I thought that was one of the most magical things I've ever seen. At the Tannen's shop on Saturdays, you would gather everybody around in a circle. And I remember the Astrosphere that somebody mentioned. I remember the jumbo sympathetic cards. And I remember the Cutmer Stewart silk, which was beautiful. Okay, and you would say, whenever you would demo something, you would say, isn't that beautiful? And it was. And you always made it beautiful. And you always made my magical life beautiful. Thank you very much.
Tony, my name is Bill Brunel. You probably don't remember me very well at all because, but we had a couple of mutual friends that I know felt very special things about you. One was Michael Pozzola. And Michael, who put out Synchronicity, some of you may remember Synchronicity, and he worked at the shop, he was a lawyer, and Michael and I were both became transcendental meditation teachers, and you learned TM from Michael, And I offered to you years ago that if you ever wanted to have your meditation checked, and that's still an offer that I will extend to you, if you ever want a little 20-minute refresher, we could do that sometime.
I think I would like another one.
Oh, I'd love to do that. But we'll make it happen. I'll come up. And the other thing is, I was a Slidini student from the time I was 15. And he was like a second father to me. And when he was first working with Carl Fulvis to put together the first black, two-volume black set, you know, the care that you put into that for Tony Slidini means so much. Those publications are still in print and classics in every magician's basic library of material that they want to study. And Tony Slidini was so grateful to you for the patience that you put in those thousands of pictures that needed to be taken. Do you remember laying those out? Yeah. It was a spectacular job with the magic community. And Slidini are very grateful for it.
Anybody else? All right. Tony, anything you want to say to the guys?
You know, these stories bring back so many memories that, you know, it's just hard to put the words in into the pictures that
like Michael Pizzola,
a long time friend, and also John, and a few of the other fellows that, you know, sent me their blessings. You have no idea. I feel like $1 million today.
So what we're going to do is, Tony's going to, don't go anywhere. Tony's going to stay over here. We're going to take a break. You guys want to come up and say hello to Tony, pay your respects. Maybe you can go out into the hall over there. It's a little cooler. And then we'll resume in a little bit. All right? Thanks.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for organizing.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for coming, guys. You made it happen. Yeah.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. I brought you this.
Oh, excellent.
I went shopping down the hall there. It was on the windowsill. I thought it would dress up the table a little bit.
Yes, it does.
You know, in true talk show history.
That's right, right in front of my face. Yeah. That's perfect, okay. So.
Is the thing that people do, right?
That's right.
And I figured awesome. I might be able to bribe you out of your martini.
That's good luck with that.
That's
right. But anyway, I think it's excellent. I think let's put that so that everybody can see it somewhere. Okay, perfect. No, but I will put that in my room later. No, I tell you what. Listen, yes, I will.
Good.
That's right.
So good to see you.
Yes, Patrick, very good to see you. Thank you very much for joining us up over here. We're going to have some fun here this afternoon, regardless of what you may think of it. Now, I want to ask you about Detroit. There is a rocker, I think, that lives in Detroit also.
There's one or two. There's one or two, yes.
Okay, yeah, Detroit rocks. Okay, but Chris...
Not Chris Rock.
No, not Chris Rock.
Kid Rock.
You put Chris in my
head. That's right.
You're good.
Now, I thank you very much. That's what I do. You are a mind reader and have worked around the Detroit area and up into Canada, I assume, and everywhere as well.
Yeah,
Have you ever worked for celebrities? And I'm thinking then of Kid Rock in particular.
I've worked,
done a lot of things with Detroit.
I've worked for Chris. I've worked for the Kid.
Was that a slip?
I worked for Metallica. I worked for...
Ted Nugent, unfortunately. It's being recorded, isn't it?
No, she can lie out.
But he wanted to kill a buffalo in the show.
Who did?
Or a bison in the show. Ted Nugent. So this was back in 2000. They did a big Millennium Bash show with Metallica, Kid Rock, Ted Nugent, and the band Seven Dust. And they wanted a bunch of entertainment to come out at midnight on stage and do a big celebration. And then they had a few of us come and work the VIP room after the show. So I got to perform for the Kid, and I got to perform for all the guys. And there was a big thing with Ted Nugent at the time that he wanted to ride out on a live, I think it was a live buffalo, and then he wanted to murder it on stage in front of a stadium of people, which is horrifying, really.
It's something you remember, like eating a live bat or something. I mean, these things you remember from some of these concerts.
You know, the most interesting story, I think, about this was that we were sitting, because we, in order to get in for the show, there's massive security, so they got us all in early around noon. The show wasn't until about 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
We had to stay and be locked in with all of the strippers, all the little people, all the, everybody, right?
All the little people.
All the people.
Are you talking about dwarves or little people?
No, little
people. I mean, the people. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are dwarves? Yeah. Those are the things you
walk toss.
Through?
No,
oh,
I'm
tossing
sorry.
Things, yeah, okay. Sure. What are you talking about? I don't even know what that means.
You were a tosser.
And so, I was a tosser.
Four, tossing four.
Whatever I did to piss you off.
No.
We'll talk later. No, so we spent the day together. It was great. We were in the cafeteria having a meal together, and we were doing the unprofessional thing and talking bad about one of the guys in the show, which was Ted Nugent. None of us care for Ted Nugent, really.
Now, what kind of things you say bad about him? You just like his music?
I'd not get into that. You know, his personal decisions.
Let's record this.
Yes, let's do it. But the guy that was the meanest about it, you know, ran his mouth. We never got his name. He got up to leave. He said, "I'm sorry, who are you?" Turned out it was Ted Nugent's son.
Oh, perfect.
But thankfully, he hated his father more than we did. So it all worked out okay.
My curiosity would be, as a mentalist, then, what types of things did you do? I mean, was it kind of walk-around mentalism that you did?
In that case, in those days, it was walk-around. I did a lot of stuff, strolling for VIP. I cut my teeth doing restaurant work when I was a teenager.
I chipped my tooth anyway one day.
I probably did that a few times, too. With all the face planting that I would do.
So you did walk around, because I remember, like, at the Magic Island that we had, you know, Banachek, back in the early, late 80s, was the house mentalist and did close up there on a regular basis. And then later, Jay Schwalsh, you know, was doing fork bending and everything.
Sure.
Did you do spoon bending and silverware bending and all that?
I did. Actually, that's how I met Banachek. It was through the fork bending. I developed a fork bend that's never been in print. I've never taught it anywhere. Banachek gave me the okay to do it. But the thing about metal bending is everybody, at least at that time, I'm going to sound really old school here, and I'm young, I'm 31 years old, but
you're half my age.
But the way I had to learn metal bending, none of it was in print when I started doing it, right? I had to go and trade secrets and beg and plead to learn this stuff. And then so-and-so put out a DVD, and then so-and-so put out a DVD, and now everybody was doing it, and then Penguin put out their stuff, and the market oversaturated, so I decided to never release this thing because I also dropped it for the show because everybody else seemed to be doing fork bending or metal bending or spoon bending, and I think that stuff was great. I love it. I really do. I think
that happens. I think a lot with magic and metal. Something becomes hot, and everybody wants to do it. You know, it's the thing, and there's nothing that separates you from the others. Whenever that you join that crowd, talk about the buffalo. You get in the herd mentality, you know, and you need to break away and do something. So, what did you decide to do to break away from that?
I just started doing everything that I'm doing now. Go to the website. PatrickRedford.com is recorded, right?
It is recorded.
PatrickRedford.com, R-E-D-F-O-R. I'm kidding. I'm not. Go to that site and just hang out there and buy everything. Please.
So it's not Red Fern.
No.
So that Red Fern I had last night was wrong. If whenever I had that picture, okay, scratch that in your memory.
Flowers.
Oh!
Because I thought that you liked that sort of thing.
I do. Well, yes. Okay.
We didn't
get
them to laugh the right way, did we?
No. Coach that a little bit better.
No, but what's cool about fork bending is I would have people come back to the restaurant a week, 2 weeks, a month, even a year later, and I have people that come up to me still, and I haven't done this in years, and say, "I still have that fork that you bent for me. And can you do it again?" So occasionally I will do it for people who request it, because it's a very, very cool, very visual bend that nobody else is doing.
And when you do that, it's fork, so it's all the tines and everything?
All the tines individually bend, and they bend visually, so there's none of this violent shaking and then the reveal.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's not something you've taught in your lecture or any place at all?
No.
Yeah, okay. That is unique to you.
That is unique to me.
I think that's something
it's always good to hold some things back.
I think that's true, and you have no problem with having a pet effect that you don't share.
Yeah. Not at all.
I think there are a lot of guys who will do that also, who will say, "Okay, I'm going to perform this, but I'm not going to teach this." I think that maybe Richard had done that. I think that with the penny there yesterday that he was talking about.
And the brand is great. I agree.
See, yes, that's right. Pixie agrees. That's right.
I don't know if the people at home could hear that, but that was Pixie the dog.
Okay. I thought it was Pixie the dust.
The only dog fan that I'm aware I have. Sorry. You know what we can go into, just because a lot of people I know are confused, because there's something weird about my name.
Would you please, yeah, or George State.
Or George State. I haven't really explained this at this convention yet. And usually at the top of my lecture I explain that that's the first lie you're going to hear when I'm introduced as Patrick Redford. My name is actually George Tate. I perform as George Tate. I was born, well, I was sort of born as George Tate. Patrick is my middle name. And when I first wrote my first set of lecture notes and released them, it was 2003, 2004, I had to make a very important decision, and that was, do I start publishing as George Tate? And if this stuff gets popular, you know, I'm going to have a problem because people looking for me to perform are going to find magic sites and magic forums. There, not all of that was just starting to get to going just then. You know, Google wasn't even a thing then.
Right.
But I had the foresight, thank goodness, because if you type Patrick Redford into a Google search engine, you'll find a bunch of magic sites. You won't necessarily find my site first. But if you type George Tate in, you find me first. So if you're looking for me, you find me. So I try to keep those two worlds different.
Separate. Just so like
Patrick is my middle name. Redford is the city I grew up in. And it's interesting that my dad, when I was born, they named me James, not George. And they got me home and they realized they didn't want two Jameses in the house. Because my dad goes by James. Coincidentally, that's not his name either. That's his middle name.
Just to add to the confusion.
No, just it's a weird family thing. So the easy way to remember it is George Tate is the guy that will perform for you. Patrick is the asshole who explains how it's done. Right? That's how
okay. Yeah, like when I was born, I think we shared this with you yesterday, that my name was Royce Lee Wells. And then within 24 hours,
everybody
my dad came
in.
And
going to call you Royce. Royce,
that's right. Yeah,
that's right.
Hope not. So then my dad came and said, let's change it to Scott Ray. And so before it went on my birth certificate, it was changed like that. Yep, yeah, a little bit. And so that you decided to go into mentalism instead of into magic. And why did you like that venue or that rather than the other when everyone else was doing card tricks around?
Well, my first love was cards. I love card tricks, but everything I've always done always has had a mental flair to it. I still performed an ambitious card routine, but I perform it as a mental effect. I perform it as an amnesia effect. Some of you have probably seen that act that I do after doing it a long time. And I have a library of over 2,000 books at home, and I've read every single one of those books. So I'm a huge magic geek, as well as just going out there and working. So I have a huge love for magic, a huge admiration for magic, but I think that mentalism always has that little bit of an edge that could be a little bit more real. It's taken a little bit more seriously rather than being the birthday party clown. Although there's nothing wrong with being a birthday party clown, but that's what my dad is.
As a mentalist.
Maybe not as a mentalist.
Well, to think, you know, that Max Maven started out as a clown, birthday clown, I think.
I have a huge admiration for clowns, because anybody who can do that and continue to do that and do a good job at it has my respect.
Speaking of geeks and nerds and the like, that I wanted to ask about comic books.
Sure.
Because that you are known for illustrating and publishing some magic-related comics. How did you get involved? Do you consider yourself an artist, a graphic artist?
I'm not much of an artist. Actually, with the comic books, I had a professional artist come in and do the art on those. I did the covers, I did some of the hand illustrations.
The storyline and all.
And I did the storyline and I wrote them. I do really good hand illustrations, so if you have a project that you're working on, you need somebody to draw the hands, I can do that for you if I have the time. But these are beautiful, beautiful things that I would never be able to do. He's done them partly in watercolor, he's done them in digital color, he's done lots of different mediums over the years that we've done this. There's five of them.
How many in each series, or each one?
How many?
No. What I mean is how many issues... How many copies of each issue did you publish?
That depends on which issue we're talking about.
Okay.
It got less and less as we went on.
It's more and more.
The first one that
people
we
didn't like it or what?
No, people loved it. It got expensive for me to produce
them. That makes sense.
But the first one, we sold something like 3,000 or 4,000 copies all around the world. That was before anybody knew who I was. And there was triangle, square, pentagon, hexagon, and heptagon. And there are actually two more out there. Actually, the artist is working on them now. And we hope to release them in a hardbound. But they're really hard to find now.
That's the truth.
You can find some of them, but you can't find all of them.
Unless you're shopping around Las Vegas in a slot machine.
That's right. That's the story. Scott bought, was it the Hexagon? I don't remember which one it was. One of the comic books. He bought it from me. And we got into conversation. He put it on top of a slot machine in Vegas and then forgot to pick it up when we walked away. So I get this email. I lost my comic book. Can I get another one?
No,
I'm out. I'm sorry. So I
went back and they were gone.
they're really, really cool things. If you can find a copy, some of them are still available on the website. Everything in them was impromptu mentalism.
And it had pictures of some of the guys. There were graphics of, like, Banachek. Do you have Richard Osterlin, I think, even?
I haven't done Richard yet, but he might appear in the next two. Yeah. But anybody who's been a good friend of mine, not to say that Richard hasn't been a good friend of mine, but Banachek has been in there. Matt King is in there, Max Maven is in there, even Anneman and Carol Fox are in there. Carol was a great friend of mine when he was alive. Of course, I never met Anneman, so he's a ghost in the comics, appropriately enough. And there's in-jokes for people who get the in-jokes, and there's geek references that have nothing to do with magic or mentalism, things about Back to the Future City of Lost Children, things like that. If you're a movie fan as well, there's all sorts of things hidden in the artwork that we really had a fun time doing.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, George.
Great
talking to you. Have a seat over here. We're going to get ready for our next guest over here. That'll be fine. Is Joe Atmore in here? Where's Joe? Oh, come on over. Let's give a big round of applause, and also for the amazing Dunninger. Here he comes. Hey there, Joe. Hello. Have a seat then. Come over here. This is great to have you, and again, I really enjoyed your lecture this morning about Dunninger.
Thank you.
You've been studying him accidentally, I guess. How did you first fall into liking Dunninger and decide that's who you're going to spend your life studying his life?
Well, it actually came about not knowing. I mean, in a lot of these magic conventions, they tell you how to develop characters, and I couldn't come up with anything, so I thought, why not just steal Dunninger's?
Why not? He was successful. You know.
I don't know.
If you're going to rob banks, go where the money is.
All this work. I mean, it's just easy. Just take the guy. He's dead.
What's he going to say?
Now the real story. Had Encyclopedia of Magic as a kid, which I think we all ended up getting at one time in our lives. And then... wanted to learn more about Dunninger. I lived in Philly. I was born in Philadelphia. Maybe I should go by Joe Philadelphia here.
Yeah,
here.
That's right.
George Detroit.
Yeah, Joe Philadelphia.
And
another new name for you.
Because I need more.
Creston was always on TV on the Mike Douglas show, and so I was looking at him. Thought he was real. Started to do because I was a kid, and then started to, who was before Preston.
And it was not real?
No, I'm afraid not.
He's just a painting. He's really not there. He's just a stiff cardboard guy.
If you think of the color blue, is that a figment of your imagination?
Almost like a joke, but not quite funny. Okay.
And then just starts, started researching his life, and then just kind of got all involved in just a series of things. I wanted to do the first. I had material, so I thought put out a book. Did the show in Vegas, and then for the last 10 years, just studied all his television work, and then it kind of dovetailed into the Geller work, which I do too.
Now that's what leads to my next question about your relationship with Uri Geller. Did he contact you, or how did you actually fall in with working with him?
I'd never met him before, and I was working for Guy Badley as a private consultant when he was on Phenomenon, and Banachek was actually the consultant for the series. So I had asked Banachek, "You got to introduce me to the guy." While I was on the set, I was introduced to Geller, and it was just a meet and greet. Here's the photo, here's the card, and it was over with. And then we knew the series was going to be in Germany for 3 months, and Banachek couldn't make it, and Banachek recommended me to Geller, and it was, I think it was like the middle of November when I show up at the studio, and Geller says, "I need to go on a walk with you." So we're walking around, security guards behind us, it's totally cool, and Geller just says, "Hey, can you come to Germany for 3 months and be my consultant for the show?" And sure, I'll give it a shot. I said, like David Berg was taught me, you always say yes, and then you figure out what the hell you're going to do later. And so I said yes, got booked to be the consultant for the German show, and they decided to do a Dutch show at the same time and just offset it by a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And so then I got booked to do that, and then that's...
Now, as a consultant, then, are you giving him ideas, or are you just kind of brainstorm, or what does that exactly entail as a consultant?
Basically everything. So I'm writing.
So you get his cookies and his coffee and all that?
That really was not supposed to be public knowledge. write scripts, produce segments, create material for everybody on the show, A lot of the performers are brand new performers that have never been on television, and so I teach them how to perform on television as well. And
because there is something special. I mean, people who are performing on stage is completely different than being in front of a camera.
100% different. So you had close-up guys that just didn't know what to do. They're turning their backs to the cameras. They just don't even know how to interact with we always had celebrity guests. And there's a technique for working with celebrity guests. There's a technique working for working with the audience. And you must know how to do that for television. And then there's also time constraints, too.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of go on as long as you want, but if you have 8 minutes, it's 8 minutes.
You know, there was something that I had heard from Paul Daniels whenever he was first on television. They'd given him a certain amount of time, but he was saying, he would start a trick, say, we will finish this or we're going to do something in the later part of this. And so they had to keep coming back to him to kind of finish it. So he had two or three things. And so after the commercial break, they'd have to come back to him. So he got more time out of it by doing it
right. That way. No, each contestant, and even Ori Spot, was a set time. And it was a live show, so what we ended up doing is during every commercial break, we'd find out what the time is, what needed to be cut, what needed to be sped up or lengthened. And in some of the countries, you had exactly an hour, like at NBC here, and in other countries, we had free reign. And I think I might have mentioned this morning.
Commercial breaks?
No, there's still commercials.
Okay.
But one of the shows went 3.5 hours long. Live show, all mentalism, and it was still one of the highest.
There's still an audience.
Oh, God, yes, yeah. Huge. So we had about 1,000 people in the audience, as well as millions watching.
Right.
So it was always ranked number one. In most countries, it was ranked number one.
How does it differ from one country to the other? I mean, I've noticed that in different parts of the U.S., even whenever I'm performing, that, you know, like from... I know there's an audience in Minnesota because they cast the shadow. So I know there's somebody out there sometimes. You know, there are different places, you know, in Texas that they are, you know, react a little different than they do in Chicago, you know. You find that from country to country as well, that you might have to script things differently?
Yeah, it's language. Okay, that didn't go over well either. Come on, that's the difference.
See, again, it's almost like humor.
But seriously, language was a big difference because we were doing a routine in Germany where we used the bell because every home had a bell in Germany and you'd ring that bell...
For
Christmas.
Oh, okay.
For Christmas to bring that... And we wanted to do the same routine for the Dutch show. Dutch families don't have bells. They don't have... So we had to redo the routines. But yeah, so there were certain... There was forces. Now, that's interesting. We were doing psychological forces. It is different in every country because of their background. So sometimes I'd have a routine, and I think it's the greatest thing, and I go and I talk to the Greek team... And they just tell me flat out, it will not work, because that's not how we think. It might work in Holland, but it's not going to work there. But those were mostly the adjustments.
Right. I remember, I think there was a model of car. It was called the Nova, Chevy Nova, which sold well in the U.S., right. But I think in Spanish-speaking countries, it didn't sell because it means no go.
Right,
won't work.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But the performers performed in their native language. Ori would speak in English, and it was either subtitled or voiceover.
Translated,
voiceover.
He would dub his voice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, no. You would hear his voice very lightly in the background, and then there would be an overriding voice that shot out over the audience for that. So, but those were the main differences. Are that some countries didn't like the danger tricks, which everybody smash and stab.
Exactly.
Like that. And if you did that, and it was a contest, you'd be voted out. Whereas in other countries, give me more danger.
That's what they want. And that was kind of like in the Phenomenon series. I think that when Gafanchik was telling me that someone had done a smash and stab, and then the producer said, we want more of that.
Yes, yes. And that's the problem. As a performer, you try to have your integrity, you try to want to do what you want to do, but you're going to be told what to do. And so I performed in Russia, and... I was performing the next night, and it was about 5 o'clock, and they said, sure, you can be on the show. Fine, no problem. Come with us the next morning at 8 o'clock with 10 ideas that you want to do. And I'm like, of course, no problem. I go back, I have no props, so I make a list of 10 things that I'd like to perform from, the one I really want to do to the least. And of course, at the production meeting the next morning, as we go through each one, they picked the 10. And, but it's, do you want to be on TV or do you want to do what they tell you to do? And I knew I could do well with it, but that's what you have to, potentially give up if you're performing on television. You're not running the show.
Right, they are, and they know what they want,
exactly.
Even though that it may be the wrong decision
yes.
in some cases.
And you can kind of twist it to what you want, but if they say this is what we want to see, then you do it.
Yeah. Would you prefer to perform on television yourself personally, or prefer stage?
Gosh, I like them both. TV, though, I just absolutely love TV, because there's so much you can do, even if it's live.
But don't you feel like you burn through material? Because people have seen that, then you can't do like night after night, like Darren Brown.
You know what? To me, that was the biggest thrill of working on the show, is having to come up with so much new material for every single episode. And one of the for me personally, the greatest things was I arrived at the studio at about 3 o'clock, and they said, quick, the producers and directors want to see you on stage. I go on stage. They go, we can't do this routine tonight for certain reasons. You have to come up with something in an hour, and we're going live like 3 hours after that.
You have to scrap some things and start almost from scratch.
Yeah, and to me that was just great. I mean, I just love the challenge of just coming up with stuff. And that's kind of like what I do with my Dunninger shows, change it every single night.
Yeah, but you kind of know it at least in advance, as opposed to 1 hour before. It's like, oh my goodness.
Oh, exactly. And I just refer to my own book, so.
Yeah, but that makes it good.
So it's kind of cheating.
What books are those? You want to plug the books while you're here on the show?
Well, one's out of print, so I can't really plug it.
You can buy it in PDF? No?
No, never. Never reprint either. The latest one is called Dunninger.
You like that, George? You don't say no?
No, I've been pressured, but I refuse to. Dunninger Knows is the latest one, and it covers basically every single TV appearance, what he performed, the history as well of his TV stuff, and how the routines might have actually been performed, or what the methods were behind it. And I used, all my friends helping, Max, Max Maven, Richard Oslin, Luch, Colin McCloud, all the guys. Banachek.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cool. And they can get that again. The website would be?
JosephAtmore.com.
That's easy enough.
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Time. Let's give Joe a big round of applause. Woo! Over here. If you can move on down over there. Then. Great. Thank you. Get ready for our next guest, someone who's more of a local guy over here, since we are in Somerset, New Jersey. Someone that's just kind of up the road. Please welcome, if you would, please, Ted Carmelo. Here, Ted, come on, have a seat over here. You didn't bring any gift, neither did Joe. I mean, I appreciate the plant, by the way. Okay, water. Okay. Yes, please, have a seat.
Wait.
So, got something?
Oh,
thank you. That's right. They can recharge me later. Or I'll charge you later. Okay. So, you actually live in the area, is that right? So you're just up the road here in New Jersey?
A little bit south, down near Princeton, right outside of Princeton.
And did you go to school at Princeton?
Actually, I started off at Rutgers. I was there for a couple years, left, and finished up down in South Jersey at Stockton State College. So I was working actually in the casinos to pay for my college education, and got a reputation while I was down in the casinos of being a mind guy.
Yeah.
And had the opportunity to do a few things, a few publicity stunts while I was in college down in Atlantic City. One of the interesting stories that I can tell you from Atlantic City was Atlantic City Magazine had heard about me, and they said, we would love to come and interview your boss and interview you, and maybe could you do some things in the casino for us? So I said...
In one of the lounges or for the pit bosses?
They wanted to go to the tables and see if I can actually,
cheat.
Well, use my psychic ability to predict things.
Okay.
So I said, yeah. I said, if you don't mind, I'm going to have a few other reporters come with us. And Atlantic City Magazine said, this will be great. So went into the lobby, and I had them take a deck of cards and shuffle some cards up, and they would deal out 2 blackjack hands, and I would tell them what I would do without even turning the cards over. And sure enough, every time they turned the cards over, everything that I predicted that I would do would be a winning hand.
Yeah.
So then they said, well, what about inside the casino? I said, well, I really don't want to go in there because there are cameras. We'll do one thing very quickly. So the 2 reporters and I go over to one of the roulette tables, and I said, I'm going to actually cause a number to come up. So I'm there with Atlantic City Magazine and the Atlantic City Press guy. I took a pad, I wrote down a number, I gave it to the Atlantic City Press guy. I said, don't even look at it at this point, just hold it up against your chest. And we concentrate. And ball goes around, and it stops on 21. And I said, look at the number I wrote down. I didn't even touch the pad. And the Atlantic City, and he shows the other guy, and it's 21. And I go, come on, we've got to get out of here. Well, the interesting thing is the other reporter happened to be Mark Skye with a Swami gimmick on him.
Good to have him.
He goes, oh, my gosh, it's 21, right?
Yeah, nice one.
Well, I kind of always agree with Adam. And, you know, if you take seven people to fool one person, you do it. So I got a nice write-up.
Yeah. Did you do a lot of things also for the college when you were growing up then? Going to school?
I did a lot of, well, when I was in high school, I think I grew up in the golden age of mentalism.
What would you call it? Why do you call it a golden age?
Uri Geller, the amazing Kreskin. I mean, that's when mentalism, in my mind, really became popular via TV and radio and all the talk show appearances. And I think if it wasn't for Uri Geller and Kreskin, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now. But I remember, you know, even in high school, doing publicity stunts and all those sorts of things. When I was a senior in high school, one of the local radio stations gave me a 15-minute spot every Friday. So I'd come home from school, they'd put me on the air, I'd do something with the host, do something with listeners. An interesting story is that at the time when I was doing the radio appearances, I was teaching one of my girlfriends at the time a simple code. We were doing simple code things. And I would go over her house, and I'd be able to code like an ESP symbol or a playing card. And so one Friday afternoon, she came on the radio station with me and introduced her to the host, he introduced her as my protege. So she went into another studio so she could hear, but she couldn't see what was going on. So I had the host, you know, take some ESP symbols, put them in a pile face down one at a time, and I'm busy coding to her exactly because they're marked on the bag, so I'm coding the order. And then he picks a card, and I kind of code that to her. So she comes back into the studio, and she's duplicated all five symbols, and she's picked the exact same card. So he was very, very impressed. More impressed were her sister's friends. Her sister would be hanging around the kitchen watching us doing this code stuff. And the day that we were doing the live radio broadcast, she was at the beach with her friends. And as she's listening to this on the radio at the beach, she's going, "That'll be a star. It's going to be the king of clubs." And all her sister's friends are like, "How do you know all of this stuff?"
I think David Hoy had a regular radio show that he was doing then for a while.
Taking a lot of questions. Well, I've done a lot of comedy clubs in the past, and one of my favorite things is to get up early and go on the radio and do stuff for the listeners. And I used to do a lot of stuff down in the South, and I've actually had some stations where they didn't even... I had one DJ, and you know, one of these wacky morning Zoom kind of things, and one of the DJs says, "I will not be in the studio with him."
Really? Because they thought you were too... They freaked him out.
You're talking about the Bible Belt in some areas, and so they kind of got put off by that. But again, I always try to keep my stuff upbeat, funny, you know.
Yeah. So do you script your shows then when you're doing something, or do you kind of have some things in mind, then you kind of go with the flow on a zoo? I guess you have to.
I've got certain things that I will use on a radio that I'll play on a radio thing. In terms of my normal act, I mean, it's pretty much the same act that I've been doing for about 30 years. And I change things up every now and then just to try to test out some new material. It's been said, and I'm sure these guys are familiar with it, you know, they say an amateur is somebody who does different things for the same people, you know, and a professional does the same thing for different people.
Right, right. Now, and Doc Hilford's lecture the other night that he was commending you for, you know, coming up with the Mother of All Book Test, and particularly at the time that you did, of writing a book that actually has a storyline and something that can be read and understood and appreciated, but also that people don't necessarily today appreciate how difficult it was to produce that and have it published, how expensive and everything that would have been 18 years ago or so. You want to talk a little bit about the development of that?
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I remember going to Tannen's, and a new book test had come out, and I was in love with book tests, and the one that I bought I wasn't happy with. So I'm sitting on the bus coming back from New York City, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, what would be the ultimate book test? How do you get there? And I had the idea for the first letter, which I didn't know had been used in a magazine test. I had no idea UF Grant had used that previously. So I had this idea, and I talked to Mark about it, and I said, you know what, if we could create a whole book of this. And Mark had, you know, one of the first generation's computers, and I wrote the story, and it took a while to do that, and we printed it out on the computer. And I'm a member of what's called the New York City's 13. And every meeting, we meet once a month, I would always bring some new book test that I've created. And to the point where the guys were pretty much sick and tired of it. And
what comes in with another book?
Well, so after Mark and I had produced this one book, and at one of the meetings we announced, we said, you guys want to be here at the next meeting, we're going to show you a great book test. And Brother Shadow said, well, if it's not any word on any page, don't even bother showing it. And Mark goes, it's the mother of all book fests.
He came with the idea.
He came up with the title, exactly. And so the first time I actually did it, the 13th with, was at the very next meeting. And I gave the book to Ken Weber, and I said, Ken, you know, turn to a page, think of a word, make it long, make it challenging, whatever. And first letter of T, he says, no, it's the letter P. And I said, okay, we'll visualize the whole word. And I'm going, I get pillowcase. And King goes, yeah. And everybody else is like, all right, what else do we have today?
No big deal.
And Ken goes, wait, do you realize what just happened? He gave me a book. I turned to any page. I thought of any word. Can you do it again? I did it a second time. And now we had everybody's attention.
Yeah.
So now we started to explain it. And we produced some copies for the local for the members of the 13. And we were fortunate enough to keep it underground for 5 years. With people doing it and coming back with tips and suggestions and techniques, and that's something the 13 has always been great at. So it kind of came out of that.
Now, how did you produce though? I mean, did you gum the edges? Did you print the page? We didn't do this before desktop publishing.
We actually printed out separate pages and took it to a binder, and let the binder take care of that.
And you got a cover and everything for it. It was a paperback.
It was actually a hard cover. As a matter of fact, one of the books that I used last night was actually the very first original one that I took to a 13 meeting. So I've been using that for so many years.
And so from that, you continue to develop it over the years?
Yeah, so over the year, you have more ideas and more suggestions, and then you get to the point where people say, well, I don't want a hardcover. I'd like to have a paperback because it's easier to carry around. So we went in that direction, and then people said, well, can you add a few things for us? And we had personal requests. And it's to the point where Mother 2.0 involves so many different things that you can do with it, where you can almost do an entire act just based on one book.
Yeah. Now, as I was talking with Joe about the differences in other countries, and obviously language, you know, is a big difference.
All right.
Have you had that reprinted in other languages?
It has. Well, actually, it has been, but not officially, until this past week. I've been in contact with a gentleman over in France who's going to produce it in French. So you keep your and exactly, and I've heard nice things about Ludo.
That's not Ludo, is it?
It is Ludo.
He just did our
fantastic. So yes. So anybody who speaks Canada is looking forward to it. So yeah.
Psychological Subtleties 1, 2, and 3 will be released in French shortly.
Excellent.
Same guy.
Terrific. But other than that, no, I haven't.
Because I was wondering, you know, that they would have long words. I assume too is the same premise basically.
I would guess so. I mean, Martin would be able to speak to that.
And now you say there have been other unauthorized editions in TED. What, in other, like German or something? Or what?
Well, there's been unauthorized editions in English. There's been a French version that was released, and I've heard of a German version as well.
Interesting. And what is the long-term, what's the plan? I mean, as far as not just with that, but other kinds of things. I mean, have you taken off with some other great ideas?
Well, for me, I love what I do. I get a chance to perform it, to entertain, but I also get to work on the creative side. So I love creating effects, and as Joe, I've worked on a number of television series and specials and those sorts of things. So to me, it's the best of all worlds.
A little bit of everything, then.
Kind of everything. It's mainly performing, but again, on the creativity side, I love to do that.
That sounds great. Well, thank you, Ted. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for the time.
Ted Carmelovic over there. Seat over there. I think, is Richard Osterlin still in here? Richard out there? Nope. Isn't? You want to grab Richard over there for just a minute? While he's doing that, Bill Gladwell, I want you to come over here for just a second. Okay. Then I'm going to have Bill something a little bit different. That one of the registrants from the convention that was not actually one of the scheduled talent, but if I can have a round of applause for Bill Gladwell. Bill, come to see. Now, I know that everybody out there has a show or something that they've always aspired to and wanted to have an opportunity, perhaps, to have their own show. I want you guys, if you haven't had an opportunity to meet Bill, to at least... you might afterwards want to say hello or something to him because he's got his own show then in Gatlinburg.
That's right.
Pigeon Forge.
Gatlinburg.
In Gatlinburg. Yeah. I want to tell a little bit about how you kind of got started with that and how you negotiated your deal with it.
Just took a chance is what I happened. I lived in Columbus, Ohio, and I traveled around doing corporate work as a stage hypnotist. And I did that for 23 years. And everything was going well. The economy got bad, and some of the corporations didn't want to hire entertainment anymore because entertainment and marketing was the first thing to go. Yeah. So I got a cold, by the way. Thanks for putting up with me. So I decided to move. It was either Atlantic City, Vegas, Gatlinburg, or Branson. And Gatlinburg seemed like the safe place to move to because it was still close to Ohio. And I gave myself 2 years. And I moved down there, and I stopped everything and took a chance. I rented a cabin in the woods in the mountain. And I got a job at Hard Rock Cafe as a server and hated it. I respect servers, but I would never do it again. And I gave myself 2 years to find a theater down there because before I went down, I began to call all the theaters and the different venues that they had in Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg area. Nobody would talk to me because they didn't know me. So I knew that I had to be face-to-face with them in order to get anything done. So I started to meet with the theaters, as many as I could, and I finally found one. And they had me come in. And at this point, I had never put together a mentalism show. And I had never seen a mentalism show other than some things on TV. And I met with them for 2 hours. The owners of, if you've been to Gatlinburg, it's the Space Needle. And they built a 90-seat theater in the bottom of the Space Needle. And at the time, there was a hypnotist in there performing about 3 nights a week. So I approached them. And actually, I called the hypnotist first. He would never call me back. So I approached the owners of the Space Needle, and I said, you're dark 4 nights a week. Let me come in on the dark nights, and you have people coming in every night of the week. I met with them for 2 hours, and they liked me, but that's all they knew. They didn't see any performances of mine or anything because there was no mentalism performances. And they said, well, we need to see you in action. Can you give us a little short version of your show? And I said, yeah, how long would you want it? And they said, about a half hour. We live about 2 hours away. And so next week, have it ready. So I put together a 30-minute show in a week. And it sucked. It really did. I thought they liked it. And it was when Eric Dittleman was on America's Got Talent. And they loved him. They loved Eric. And so they were already sold on the mentalism idea. So I did my 30-minute little routine for him. And they loved it. So we want you in. But we have to talk to the hypnotist about it. He's a little temperamental. So we'll let you know how it goes. I get a call at 12:30 in the morning. The hypnotist walked out because he didn't want any other entertainer and any other entertainer in the theater. And so I took over the whole theater and started my show the first week of August in 2012 with an hour show. I went to an hour and a half. Now it's back down to an hour and 15 minutes. It went from me not doing any kind of mentalism at all. I had done the hypnosis, but no mentalism. So now I have the number one show in Gatlinburg. It's the number two show in Eastern Tennessee. So it's going very well. At this
How about that? Is that pretty cool?
Yeah, sure.
So there is another hypnotist in there now that plays well. And if you guys know Keith Fields, I don't know if some of you know Keith Fields. I invited him down, and he did a couple days at the theater. And now he's there for spring break. He's there right now this weekend, actually until the third week of April. And then he's coming down for the summer. So if you're in Gatlinburg, you get to see Keith and myself at the same time. And but, you know, I negotiated a seven-year contract. I wouldn't have done it again. 7 years is too long. I should have stuck with 2 or 3 years, but I've been there for a while, and it's going well.
That sounds great. Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Bill. Back over here. I thought perhaps that you might enjoy just a little bit different story and something that you may not have known. All right, well, we'll start to kind of wrap up with the last guest over here that I'm going to have to enjoy the rest of the show with us before we start to strike the set, because we're going to have to get ready. I think Mark Salem's going to be coming in, right? You just check through customs?
Half hour.
Been here in half hour, so that's right. We're going to have time with Mark Salem. Great. So for the next 15 minutes or so, we're going to enjoy and wrap up with the one that you've enjoyed already. Please welcome Mr. Richard Osterman. Richard. Richard, have a seat. Yes, thank you so much for joining us over here. So it's been a good convention for you?
Oh, yeah. I was just talking with Tony in the other room, reminiscing over old times.
Yeah, well, you were talking with him then a little bit earlier over there, and that you were opposite of David Copperfield. Tell that story a little bit more.
Well, it was at the point where I had gone from, like, a student, and Father and Tony and Red and all the other guys in Tammins every weekend, you know, show me this, to the point where I actually had a career starting. And Tony was nice enough to book me in the Tannins Jubilee in Browns, and And, you know, that was the, for me at the time, that was like the biggest thrill in the world. And then I get there and I got a show all lined up. I'm all excited. And I look at the schedule at the same time. They had interview with David Copperfield at the exact same time.
Yeah. So either Richard Osterlin or David Copperfield.
Exactly. And this was just when David was just, you know, having TV specials and everything. So I went up to Tony and I said, Tony, what are you doing to me, you know? And I said, who's going to come to see me? And he said, yeah, you're right. So he switched it. And it went great. Yeah. You know?
Now, was that the first time that you had met David Copperfield? And did you try to teach him some mentalism?
Actually, no. I'll tell you how I met David Copperfield. It was kind of neat. David's a great guy if you ever get a chance to meet him. He was already, like, had a couple of TV specials. And I lived at the time in right outside New Haven, Connecticut. And I forget if it was at the Palace or the Schubert, one or the other. He would come once a year. And so I went down to see him. And afterwards, he was signing autographs. And so I was standing in line, you know, waiting to get his autograph with my family, and went up to him, and, you know, he said hi, and I said, hi, how you doing, Dave? And he said, what's your name? I said, Richard Osterlin. He goes, oh, stand over there, I'll get back to you. So after he got through signing, signing autographs, and everybody was going, he goes, he didn't say much. He came over, he took me by the hand, said, come with me, and we went and sat down in the first row. Of the theater, like I said, the Palace, big theater. And he sits down next to me, just like this. And he goes, so what'd you think? And I was like, what do I think? You know, you're the greatest guy in the world. You know, it was incredible. You know, he goes, no, seriously, what'd you think?
Okay,
you know?
Sorry.
And then at that point, you know, we started talking about individual tricks. And then after that, for a few years, to show you the kind of, I mean, I remember he took me then, to the trailer that he traveled around in. And they had filmed the show. They used to film the show every night and review the show every night. See, when they first started out, he would do a TV special, and then they would travel around the country and do the show. And then after a while, he realized it was better to travel around the country first and put the show together and then film the special, and everything was perfect by then.
Right.
And so they actually shot every single show. Imagine if you shot every show and sat down and watched it through. How good you'd get after a while, you know. So at that point, he would call me. You know, I was doing a show in Arizona. I was outside. It was like a Coliseum show, and I'm standing outside waiting to go on to do the show in about half an hour. My cell phone rings, and it's like hello. And the first time David, I'm going backtrack. The first time David ever called me, it was like at. Yeah, I know it. I was sitting at home, you know, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and he goes, hello. Or I say hello, and he goes, hi, it's David. And I said, David who? He goes, David Copperfield. And it's like, come on, who's this, you know? And then he goes like, no, it's me. And he had that voice, and I said, it's David Copperfield, you know? So after that, you know, I was standing outside and waiting to go on, all dressed up, waiting to go on and do a show in Arizona. My cell phone rings, and I pick it up, and it's him. And he wanted to talk about something in the show. So we're talking. And then he says, oh, okay, I got to go now. I got to get back on stage. And I realized that he had called me during the break, the intermission, you know? I mean, that's how hard, you know, but that's how hard he works, you know? And
they started doing some consulting for him then also. Is that right? I mean, we were talking also about Joe doing some consulting for Uri, and that how did he contact you and start confiding in you?
Well, like I said, he just called me up one day, you know, and...
I mean, what had he seen of yours?
I had a couple books out. Maybe by then I had Challenge Magic. I don't know what it was. I had a couple books. Tony, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Tony was responsible for having David at a number of things, and Tony used to carry my stuff by then. By then I had the Ultra Board and some other things out in the market, and
right.
And so that's how it came to happen.
Now, you've done some television shows you've done some television shows as well, like some of the other guys saw over here then on the couch then as well. And do you enjoy television more or about the same as live performances or what?
Yeah, I enjoy television. If anybody hasn't television and you're going to do television, let me tell you what you insist on. A monitor. You have to see...
That was what you were talking about Deniger, that he had the monitor, he could see with the blindfold.
Oh, yeah. If you're ever going to do that, make sure, don't go on unless you have a monitor. Because you never know what they're going to look at and where the cameras are. But if you see them have a monitor in front of you, you know what's going on, you know, in at home. So that's vital, you know.
You know, I learned that the hard way when I was doing something on television once. I was doing Cups and Balls. Well, I had not
spent enough time talking with the camera operator, first of all, and when I watched it later, I mean, all the cameras were on my hands as I was trying to misdirect, and so the lady I was interacting with was having a great time, you know, and she was fooled and laughing and whatnot, but when I watched, it's like, okay, here's the load here and there, you know, and because the cameras were burning my hand, they weren't giving it a wide shot, you know.
And you know why? Because these camera operators, they don't think about, well, this is entertainment. They think I'm going to expose the guy or something like that. You know, that's what they're like, got the news frame of mind. Like, yeah. You know, a big scandal is going to happen here. I saw the guy take a ball out of his pocket. I'm going to capture that, you
know. Where did the rabbit come from? He put it in first.
Yeah, that's just the way, you know, they so you got to just make sure that you can see what the home audience sees, you know.
And it's important, I think, then also that they know what cues you want, what camera angle. You can't do a rehearsal.
Right, yeah. Usually rehearsal, yeah. That would be great, but that doesn't happen too often. Yeah.
Do you like working television?
I do. I do. You know, I've done some news shows like Fox and Friends and things like that, but I also on a more local scale, like a couple back in Kentucky, I don't work there a lot, but a couple times, every couple of years, I'll do like a fundraiser. Like we had a soup kitchen down where I live, and I did a fundraiser, and they had me on TV for that, or I worked at a... down in Lexington at a pretty large comedy club, and they had me running around for five different TV studios in one day doing shorts there, you know. So it's a lot of fun. It's exciting, you know. It's a different feeling. It's excitement.
Well, along that line, I'm going to address this to each of you guys. I'm going to hand the microphone, first of all, then down to you, George, about what would be, you can be thinking about this, what would be perhaps one of your most exciting venues, one of your best shows, something that you have done that has been the most fun or the most outstanding. And usually when I ask that question, something immediately comes to mind. You might start thinking, well, no, that wasn't so great. But there is something, perhaps, that might have been like a great show. So, George, let me just ask you.
I thought I got time to think about it. You were going to pass it down. Now I'm on the spot.
Keep it for at least five minutes.
All right, I'll try to stall as much as I can. Yeah, you know, I've had the fortunate ability to do consulting work for TV, too, and I have the stuff that I love to do, and I've worked on television. But I really love working large theaters. You know, I love intimate crowds like this. These are some of the best crowds. But I've worked 3,000 and 10,000 seat venues. I've worked stadium venues on stage. And when you do that, oh man, especially the first time you do that, it's a whole different experience. Just the time it takes to get one guy out of the audience to the stage, you don't realize until you've done it, you got to do something while that's happening. And you also don't realize that when you're on stage, as soon as you step off stage, you lose everybody, even in a small room like this. If you step off this platform, you lose the audience really, really quickly. Richard, you're really great at that, though. You don't lose your audience. No, it's going out and working in the crowd, because when you step off stage, all eyes are on you, and you make sure everyone can see, and you work the room. And I see a lot of guys who do that. They step off stage, and they...
One, this is gone.
They lose the mic, then they lose the audience, and then you have no control anymore.
Yes,
you know?
When I'm doing
a real show, I don't mean to disrupt you, but when I'm doing a real show, well, a real corporate show, we have two spotlights. One for the stage and one to either the audience or follow me if I go out there. So, yeah, to go out there in the audience in the dark, forget it. You know, but if you know ahead of time, if you go out there, a spot's going to follow you out there. Different story. Now you're taking the stage there.
I called you out, so that's okay. So one of my favorite venues that I was working, I was doing my Rock, Paper, Scissors opener, and there were about 3,000 people in the room. And when I do it the right way, the first round, about 75% of the room sits. In the first round, I condition the audience to throw scissors. I'm supposed to throw a rock, and I beat at least 75% of the room. Now, this was 3,000 people in two rounds. After two rounds, there were 10 people standing.
Wow.
That's such a cool feeling. Such a cool feeling. One of my other favorite memories of working a large crowd like that, I was doing the thing that I did last night with the four colored envelopes. And I usually do the same thing. Everybody stands up. Everybody thinks of a color. And I have the people sit down. They got the correct color. But when they all sat down, I need four people on stage for what I'm going to do. And guess how many people were standing? There was four people. Perfect. I never had any less than that. And most of the time, that's only happened once. But what a great feeling, right? When you get the exact right amount of people on stage. And I will never forget that. I mean, it's a little thing. And of course, when that happens, you can't stand there and get excited about that. You have to pretend that this is how it goes every single time. But inside, you're going, yes! But you can't let on. You have to do it. Over to you.
Okay. You got 5 minutes? Is that good?
That's good enough. Well, when I went to my grandmother's house with my leaking rings, no. And honest to God, she goes, there's a space in between them. Thanks for helping. I still turned out okay, I think. Okay, two things, and I've mentioned it here, and I mentioned in my lecture that when I did the Geller spots for Russia, and I don't speak Russian, and my earpiece falls out, and I have no idea what anybody's talking to me, but I think I still pulled it off. To me, that was just a really, really cool experience, because it's live TV, you don't stop, and I still had to hit the amount of time. But I think the thing that really, and for the PEA members that saw it, is when I did my first Dunninger show for the PEA conference in Las Vegas. And it was a year worth of hard work to do it. And I had Siegfried, Jerry McCambridge, and the cousin of Dunninger, which I mentioned earlier. And to me, that was like a culmination of a year worth of incredible work. And it pretty much kicked off, I think, pretty much my career after that, obviously doing the Dunninger show, but then getting the TV and everything else. And the one thing I wanted to mention is, and for those guys that were in the audience, so last night, obviously used a gimmick slate. For that, yes, I know. Okay, but this, that's, and I now have proper chalk. No, I appreciate it. Next time I'm in France, I'll buy another box. And the best thing was, most people didn't. So for this show, most people didn't know that Jerry and I'd worked on his television show, and we were really, really close. So Siegfried writes down his number. Daniel Dunninger writes down his number. Jerry writes down his number, or somebody else did, and I said, Jerry, would you add them up? And Jerry adds them up and puts the number down. But he hadn't put the third number. So we have one number, second number, and he knew the fourth number. So what he was actually doing is filling in his number, which made it add. So we then do the reveal. Everything's awesome. The slate's laying on the table. After that show was over, you would not believe how many of the PA guys walked up, picked up the slate. Where's the switch numbers? What the hell happened? And nobody thought, Jerry just put in the number I asked him to put in. But they're looking at it and looking at it. But seriously, that was like, that was just an awesome evening for me too. And that's it.
Well, for me, the best shows that I have are when the audience has the best time. I mean, to me, it's all about the audience. When you first start out, for me, it was always about me. And as you mature and you've done a number of shows, you realize it's not really about you, it's about the audience. And I was telling a couple of the guys, one of the best experiences I ever had, I've done a lot of comedy clubs and corporate things, but for me, I love intimate crowds. So I was doing a 40th birthday party on an estate just outside of Philadelphia. And I drive my car through the gates and you have a winding road and there's a parking area and there's a guest house and the whole thing. And so it was a 40th birthday party with about 30 guests. And so after dinner, in a converted barn, they brought me out. I entertained for about 45 minutes, did a great show. Everybody seemed to like it. And as soon as I was done, everybody went out to the patio where they had a birthday cake. And just as I'm getting ready to leave, they said, no, nobody leave yet. And they went into a fireworks display. I mean, a personal, full-blown fireworks display on this estate. And after about 5 minutes, it stopped, and I pick up my case, and I'm ready to... And it continues. And the fireworks go on for 20 minutes. I mean, 20 minutes. It was just an amazing evening. And so now, walking back to my car, the couples were leaving. There was a couple ahead of me who they didn't know I was behind them. And the guy turned to his wife and said, what a great evening. Hit St. James and fireworks. And I'm just riding cloud nine going home.
That's great. Okay, the question was about...
last
year, yeah, because we were talking about TV. So last year... I got a call from a Japanese producer wanting them. They wanted to hire me to drive a car blindfolded in Japan. And at first, you know, I knew after doing little research, it was one of these shows where you go over there and you do it, and then they try to expose you or figure out how. Dr. Leon, okay? So, you know, after a while, and they had offered
but
me pretty.
You didn't know that going into it, right?
Well, when they first called, I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And they offered me X amount of money. And I said, well, I'll think about it. That, you know, that might be fun to go there. And then when I found out about it, they called back and they said, nope, I'm not going to do it. And they offered me twice as much money. And I said, okay, I'll do it. So they paid for Lisa and I. And we actually shot it in Okinawa. And we went to a driving training course. And so imagine this. I get there. Now, they've got it scripted. You know, I thought I'd go there and just prepared to do it. They got it scripted. First thing that happens is we get there, and they've rented a brand-new red convertible Camaro, and hired this blonde bombshell model with a dress, you know, with a slit down the side, low cup. And the first shot is they put me in the car and they give me these dark sunglasses and I drive up in front of the, screech up in front of the hotel and all the cameras are there and they have me get out and this is all scripted again and you know, oh, Mr. Osterlin, you know, like that. And they're interviewing me, you know, and then it's like, oh, take off glasses, you know. And then my line, they've scripted, is I can't do that because I could damage somebody with my eyesight, you know. So we go out on the terrace of this beautiful hotel in Okinawa, and there's this big elaborate contract where I'm supposed to drive the car blindfolded, and if they can't figure out how I could do this, then I win whatever, $1 million, $100 million yen, or whatever it is. I don't even know what the amount is. So, you know, when I sign it, we give each other the stare down, you know, me and this Dr. Leon, who's like, you ever see Dr. Leon? Yeah, with this white hair, and he's got, you have to know this. It's not just on TV. Even when before the cameras are rolling, he's got a personal assistant with him, like brushing him off and fixing his hair like that, you know, and powdering his face. So, okay, so now comes the day where I'm going to do this. And first of all, it's me. Now we got the model, and she's sitting next to me, okay? And I drive up around, you know. I'm sorry, Lisa, but they just washed her right out of the picture. You know, they don't want a guy with a wife. They want a guy with a hot babe on his, you know. I come driving around, yeah, and get out of the car, you know, with the sunglasses still. And here comes, over the hilltop, here comes Dr. Leon walking by himself over the top of the hill, you know. And so I do the blindfold drive, okay. And we get all done doing it, and it's fine. You know, I have to drive around this course, you know, the first time in the Camaro, and then they want to pretend like it's my car, so they made me do it again, but with one of their cars that they use, which put the steering wheel on the other side. I've never driven a car before. Uh-huh. And here I'm driving course, so I hit a few things, but it's okay. Nothing serious. So we get all done. So now, I mean, I was using just a standard, you know, multiple blindfold, so Dr. Leon's pretty confident. So now it comes to the point where, is he supposed to expose me? But he don't want to expose me because I'm kind of a big shot. So, and he doesn't want that whole scenario. So it's like, and nobody had thought this out ahead of time. So what are we going to do? Where we don't embarrass Richard Osterlin, you know, and get him mad at us. But we got some kind of show here. So after talking, and they didn't work this out ahead of time. They didn't know where they're going with this. So finally, here's the solution. The guy comes out, Dr. Leon, you know, and says, well, that was a wonderful, you know, performance in Japanese, but says, I'll tell you what, why do you need all the claws and everything else on your head, you know, if you can really see without sight, just take this paper bag and put it over your head and do it again. At which point I become indignant. What, you want me to put a paper bag over my head? I'm not going to put a paper bag over. That's an insult, you know, because you see, like, you know, you tell me to put a paper bag over my head, that's an insult. Well, then if you don't put the paper bag over your head, you're not going to get the money. And then I turn back. I don't care about the money. I got enough money already. I just wanted to do it for you, you know. And that was the end way the show ended. So there you go.
About that. Thank you, Richard. All right, well, we're going to wrap up because we have another thing scheduled for later this afternoon. But I want to thank all of my guests here this afternoon. I want to thank George Tate over here. Thank you, George. Joe Atmore. Ted Carmelotti.
Thank you, Bill Gladwell, for coming out of the audience and coming over here then, too. And Richard Ostlund. Thank you guys very much for being here today. Appreciate you seeing. Now you see it with Scott Wells. Scotty L.